first move, and here's your need to know. Fatal flooding, more than 100 lives lost and more missing in Northern Europe. Diddy drama, the Chinese tech giant's offices visited by more than 7 regulatory agencies. And Hong Kong hazard, President Biden set to warn on the risks of doing business. It's Friday, let's make a move. Welcome again to Friday's First Move, and what a week it's been. Elon Musk's tired of the global CEO rat race. Global inflation is rising at a troubling pace. First Branson, now Bezos blasting off to near space. And Diddy's down again with more regulators on their case. I'm not done yet. Let's cut to the chase. Now I'm done. Investors chasing US stocks higher. Europe is mixed, wrapping up a pretty unsettling week, I think, for global investors. But we have seen a solid start to US earnings season. That, of course, led by the banks. And there's optimism over solid second quarter Chinese growth, too. Newly released data also showing US retail sales rising 0.6% last month. We were actually expecting a second month straight drop, but sales are still not back to April's levels as weaker auto sales are still weighing. And it's not a demand issue. We have to make this clear. People want to buy cars. It's just that there's a supply chain blockage. There's an issue there. And that demand is therefore forcing prices higher. Fed Chair Jay Powell assuring Congress once again yesterday that this is all temporary, that he won't cut support anytime soon, even as Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen sees, quote, several more months of rapid inflation. The Bank of England, though, not so sanguine. Two BOE officials now warning that it may be time to start cutting bond buying, perhaps as soon as next month, as UK inflation comes in hot too. No chance, though, of a similar jolt over in Japan. The Bank of Japan cutting its growth forecast again today, a week before the Olympic Games begins amid the ongoing Tokyo COVID state of emergency. Japan and China finishing the week lower amid continued concern over rising COVID rates in the region. All right, let's get to the drivers and to our top story today. More than 100 people have died following devastating floods in several countries in Western Europe. You are seeing video taken from Germany, where the worst flooding has taken place. Authorities say hundreds more people remain unaccounted for. Melissa Bell is in Liège in eastern Belgium after another badly affected nation. Oh, wow. And I can see you, Melissa. You're actually on a boat going down a street. Just talk us through what you're seeing and how you're having to travel here. I can see it.
Well, this is a street that has become a river, as you say, Julia, and it's a reminder. It shows you, gives you a small idea of where the water levels are, even now in Liège. This is nothing compared, though, to how high they got in some parts of this region. We're just taking part now in a rescue operation with these members of the French military who've been sent over here with their equipment, these special little boats that can be towed in and out of water fairly recently to reach people that they hadn't been able to reach before. Other parts of this area, what we've seen this morning, the little village we just came from, is water levels that really reached halfway up the houses, and the insides of the houses really turned around, devastated. People slowly coming back and trying to take stock of what are essentially their ruined homes, their ruined livelihoods. And I think beyond the question of the individual tragedies that we're seeing here this morning, the beginning of an understanding of the scale of this catastrophe across Belgium, across Germany, but also affecting parts of the Netherlands. These sheer quantities of water that have been unleashed through the waterways in those parts are really bringing chaos and devastation to so many people. Another major problem that they're having here with the rescue operations are the communications being cut. In so many parts of this area, there's no electricity, there's no water, the phone signals don't get through, and that, of course, is making efforts harder. And, of course, it's made it harder also, Julia, just to get a sense of how badly damaged these places were.
Yeah, I can see that. And I think some people, if they've just joined us, will be looking and saying, hang on a second, there are people walking around there in Wellington boots. It doesn't look that deep. But I guess this is how they're trying to keep people dry and rescuing them from their homes.
And it is from here, Julia, that we can head out onto the main river to get to the people who couldn't get out at all. So the idea is that they stop and rescue people along the way who haven't been able to make it back to the city centre, but then people further down the river who have no access at all and have been completely cut off. We've seen people being rescued from their top floor apartments. But again, this is an effort that's just getting underway. And what we heard from the locals in the village, even more cut off than here in Liège, where we were earlier on, they were saying, look, as these waters rose dramatically on Wednesday, really rising very fast and very high, furiously submerging the village, very little help was seen. And I think that's something we've heard from officials as well, recognizing locally, the president of the Wallonia region we're in, recognizing that the army, the civil defense people simply didn't have the equipment they needed to get involved as quickly as they should have been able to do.
Your point, days, weeks worth of rain in just a few hours and everyone caught off guard. Melissa Bell, thank you so much for that report there over in Belgium. All right, let's move on. Diddy drama, more pain for investors. The stock down a further 5% pre-market. China's cybersecurity regulator has confirmed multiple additional regulators visited the offices of the ride-hailing company earlier today. Claire Sebastian joins us now and has been tracking this. And Claire, and I was just looking through the whole list of the individual agencies that have gone in there. The Ministry of State Security, I believe. I mean, some of these agencies actually look for criminal activity, perhaps, too, I believe.
Yeah, Julia, it's been 17 days since the IPO, 17 days of mounting pressure on Didi. But even within that context, this is a significant moment. You see that reflected in the share price. Obviously, we saw the initial sort of 30% drop from the peak in the wake of the cybersecurity view, the app being pulled from app stores. But the stock had recovered a little bit after that. And now we see it plummeting again in pre-market. And that is, as you say, because we now have an on-site cybersecurity review going on, seven different agencies, the range of different agencies, very significant, and everything from the Ministry of State Security, which conducts counter-espionage activities, as you say, the Ministry of Transport, various others, the State Administration for Market Regulation, and of course, the Cybersecurity Administration of China, which is the one that's in charge of this cybersecurity review. That speaks not only to how seriously China is taking this, but also the range of data that Didi holds, which of course is at the core of concerns for China. And of course, they didn't have to put out a statement saying, you know, we did this, seven agencies went and did this. They could have done it on the quiet, but I think they're trying to do it publicly to send a warning shot, all part of the broader crackdown that we're seeing on these tech companies, Julia.
Yeah, they want the visibility here, Claire. I couldn't agree more with you on that point. It was interesting. I was watching some of the price action in Asia overnight, and I did see the broader markets recovered some of their ground. And there was a report suggesting that companies going public in the future in Hong Kong might not face the same level of scrutiny from regulators that companies wanting to go public in the United States might face. Admittedly, just reports, but it is and does present perhaps an argument for staying away from the United States, but also perhaps a closer or more close alignment between Hong Kong and China, which, of course, is something you and I have discussed in the past. What do we make of those reports? And did you see some of that too?
Yeah, Julia, this is a report from Bloomberg citing unnamed sources that they say that perhaps there might be an exemption from this cybersecurity review requirement. It's a new requirement for which was actually announced last weekend for companies with more than a million users to go through a cybersecurity review from the Cybersecurity Administration of China before listing overseas. There's a suggestion that might exempt listings in Hong Kong, suggesting that China wants to bring these tech companies to markets closer to home, worried again about data. And that was why, you know, it was surprising that we saw a tweet this morning, Julia, from the spokesperson for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs saying the global digital economy is an open and close-knit entity. She said win-win cooperation is the only right way forward, while a closed-door policy, exclusion, confrontation and division would only lead to a dead end. Surprising because, of course, all these actions combined, of course, with new regulatory pressure on Chinese listings in the US as well, suggest the opposite, suggest that the two countries are sort of edging towards more of a decoupling. So it's sort of interesting mixed messages from the Chinese authorities today.
Yeah, we're already there, I think, on the splinternet and the digital divide. Whether it's true or not, the battle lines, I think, are being ever more firmly drawn. Claire Sebastian, thank you so much for that. And on that point, let's go to Washington now, where the White House is planning to warn American companies about the risks of doing business in Hong Kong.
The situation in Hong Kong has deteriorated. and the Chinese government is not keeping its commitment that it made, how it would deal with Hong Kong. And so it is more of an advisory as to what may happen on Hong Kong.
And John Harwood joins us for more. John, it's always great to get your perspective on these things. My understanding is that it is going to be guidance for US firms rather than any sort of action directed towards Beijing.
That's right. And it's not going to be a mandate on American business. It's just the United States government officially reflecting the fact that, as Joe Biden said, the situation's deteriorating in Hong Kong, and that the Chinese government can expect consequences from that in terms of the attitude of the United States and American firms. You know, China promised when it took control of Hong Kong from Britain in 1997, 50 years of continuation of conditions in Hong Kong. As President Biden said, they've not abided by that, and they've been facing pro-democracy protests. They've cracked down on that. And it's a reflection of the broader rising tension between the United States and China, and the United States is going to respond.
Yeah, and President Biden said it yesterday in that presser too with Angela Merkel, that they simply aren't meeting their commitments. It's almost like a reality check of the situation that we find ourselves in. Quite interesting that virtually, at least, President Biden, President Xi are going to meet at the APEC summit, of course, in the coming hours as well. It's going to be interesting to see what comes of that in light of messages, as we were just hearing there from Claire Sebastian, saying, look, we don't want this digital divide and we have to work together. And yet it's simply not the reality that we're seeing.
Well, it's like, Julia, the situation with respect to Russia. There are going to be areas of profound disagreement. And President Biden has framed his administration as part of an effort to demonstrate that democracy is a superior system to authoritarianism. That's a fundamental difference. And you've got very specific differences with Russia over NATO and Ukraine, and with China over economic competition, military in the South China Sea, potential military confrontation. At the same time, there are areas they need to work together with adversaries, climate change, COVID being two of the most prominent ones. So how President Biden manages that a dialogue with President Xi is going to be a drama worth watching the rest of the year.
We like watching dramas, at least if we can explain them. John Harwood, thank you so much for that. Great to have you with us, and have a good weekend. All right, let me bring you up to speed now with some of the other stories making headlines around the world. The Haitian-American doctor accused of plotting to assassinate Haiti's president had outwardly been planning a peaceful entry into Haitian politics, according to a source. Instead, Colombian police say Christian Sanon secretly recruited men who knew their goal was to execute the president. CNN has obtained new video that shows the alleged assassins as they tried to elude capture several hours after the attack on President Moïse. Our Matt Rivers reports from Port-au-Prince.
Well, recently we became aware of a clip of a live stream that was taken the day that President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated, several hours after he was assassinated. This clip has made the rounds here in Haiti quite a bit, but it hasn't really been given a lot of attention internationally, especially by international media. And what it shows really is enlightening in terms of exactly what happened in the hours after President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated. Just hours after Haiti's president was killed, this video, live streamed by a local journalist, shows some of the men accused of killing him. Here you can see two of the Colombian mercenaries that officials say were part of the hit squad. The first man is holding a rifle and signals for the journalist to stop. A second then stands up, rifle glinting in the sun. They tell him to stop recording. At this point, Haitian security forces had trapped the two dozen or so alleged assassins along this stretch of road. At the bottom, a roadblock. Then the lookouts, with the majority of the suspects holed up in this building. Moving up the street and past the vehicles the suspects had abandoned on the road, the camera reaches that building. As it pans, you can see two things: several black-clad mercenaries and this man, one of the two Haitian Americans accused of taking part in the crime. At this moment, he's actually giving a live interview to Haiti Radio Mega, saying they didn't kill the president.
Someone died, but we didn't do it, he says. People inside the president's house started to shoot at us, and we fired back to defend ourselves. Vincent then says most of the group believed they were going to arrest the president, not kill him. The journalist who filmed them, Malhaiko Seneschal, who didn't want to show his face, said the group didn't seem to have a plan. He says they knew they were in a tough position and knew the president was dead. They were confused, not sure whether to turn themselves in or fight. Ultimately, some chose to fight, and a fierce shootout with police left at least three Colombians dead. The easiest way to tell who actually killed the president would be to see the footage from CCTV cameras inside the presidential residence that a source tells us captured most of what happened. But authorities have refused to release it or even describe its contents.
We know that there is CCTV footage from the presidential residence the night of the assassination. Why not release that footage to the public? Would that not answer so many outstanding questions about who did this?
So we cannot reveal to the public anything, any more information until the investigator allow us to do so.
Now, I also got the chance to ask the chief of the Haitian National Police about the fact that we haven't heard from any of the alleged suspects in this case that are detained at this moment, including the Colombians that are currently detained in Haiti. And I asked him, when we'll be able to hear from those detainees? What have they officially been charged with? Do they have legal representation? He didn't answer really any of those questions. And because of that, our questions will remain about exactly what the motive behind all of this actually is. Matt Rivers, CNN. Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Amid public frustration with government and political infighting in Lebanon, Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri has stepped down 9 months after being tasked with forming the country's next government. Hariri says he's resigned because the president didn't accept his proposed cabinet. Coming up here on First Move, rebuilding South Africa. The global superstar DJ and producer from Durban, Black Coffee, joins us to discuss. Plus, a real winner in remote learning boom. The CEO of EdTech Unicorn Go Student talks about transforming the world of tutoring. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to First Move. Following days of violence in South Africa, authorities say calm is returning to several cities with the deployment of 25,000 troops to help end some of the worst unrest in years. At least 117 people have lost their lives in the unrest, which saw widespread looting and destruction. CNN's David McKenzie asked the country's president how the government will now respond.
Mr. President, ordinary citizens have taken the law into their own hands and they feel let down by the state. Why did it take so long to secure these regions?
Yes, ordinary citizens have felt that they need to defend their areas, to defend their assets. And we welcome the fact that ordinary citizens are working together with the security forces, are standing up not only to defend their own assets, but they're also defending our democracy, because they can see that this is an assault on the democratic situation that we have in our country.
Among those hoping the South African president and the government will help address the causes of some of this unrest is Nathi Mapumulo. He's the globally renowned DJ, producer, songwriter and singer, better known as Black Coffee. He's a major name on the global club circuit, a huge promoter of South African and African music talent, and also an investor in some of the nation's top tech startups. In a tweet, he said, "After all the chaos, I hope the spirit of true South Africans emerge." And goes on to say, "I hope our government shows up." And I'm very happy to say he joins us now. Nathi, fantastic to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us. I mentioned there, I mean, and in my own personal opinion, you're a brilliant music producer and talent in your own right. But you also stepped up here to say, look, something needs to be done. I think you heard what the president said there. What do you think needs to be done, and what is your view of what we've seen in recent days?
We kind of like in a different pandemic. You know, we have like two pandemics happening. One is what's happening globally, which is COVID, and we just have our own internal issue as a country. And what we've seen happening is coming straight from people not satisfied, you know, which is, it's understandable. We are a very young democracy. You know, we are very young, and this is part of the journey. I think this is stuff that's still going to happen until we get to the right place. You know, our government is a new government. There's been so many mistakes that have been made by the government, you know. And my tweet was basically, when I'm saying I hope they show up, it's more about not just showing up in cleaning and fixing. It's just showing up for real, you know. I just feel like there's a lot of stuff that needs to be changed about the country, including the constitution, you know. And I mean that far, you know. I just hope that would deal with the real problems, not just COVID, not just like immediate hunger. I just hope like we fix the economy, and just the standard and the level of living is way different for people of South Africa, and it needs to be addressed.
Talk about some of those mistakes, and you know, you don't have to get into the politics if you don't want to. To your point, it's sort of more fundamental than that. Talk about some of the changes that you hope, and I think a lot of people that perhaps voted hoped that this government and this president could perhaps address.
Not just my country. I just always felt like just Africa as a whole, or rather an African child, deserves an equal opportunity, you know. And we've seen this for many years. That's why the continent lacks in developing faster, because we will rather take a contract, give a contract to an outsider on the continent, an outsider meaning a European company that obviously has the know-how and the experience. But what that does, it limits chances for our own people. And we've seen this happening even in South Africa, and they've tried different things. They've tried introducing the BEE to meet everyone halfway, but it's just been slow. You know, one of the things the local people were crying for is the people that were defending a very big mall in South Africa called Maponya Mall. They were complaining about how everything there is still, they've defended the mall. They like the companies that have all the jobs and all the contracts are not there to defend. It's the local people defending. It's the community defending. But tomorrow, when everything goes back to normal, the locals, the community, don't have the contracts in the mall. The contracts are held by people who are not in the community. And that's how you start fixing the problems, you know, where you allow people in the communities to be in charge, you know, of their communities, you know, in the infrastructures, in the contracts, in everything that happens around. And then they will defend it, and they will make sure it prospers. At the moment, people don't feel like they're destroying their own. They feel like they're destroying what's been there and what's not theirs, even though somehow it benefits them. You know, I think that's where the disconnect is mostly.
Yeah, it does feel like a disconnect. And I know when I watched you on social media, and there is sort of a cleanup operation going on now. And this is many small businesses that do belong to ordinary South Africans that got damaged and got destroyed. So there's a balance here too, isn't there? There's a sense that South African people need to feel ownership somehow in the things that they're trying to grow and trying to build at the same time. And I don't want to be an outsider in some way patronizing, and I don't think anybody does. It's this balance of providing help, support and encouragement, but at the same time, people feeling that sense of ownership there.
Yeah, I mean, I spent a weekend in New York, the 4th of July weekend.
Right.
And I was telling a friend of mine that I was so jealous to see how Americans take their Freedom Day seriously. Like, it felt like New Year's Eve. You know, and stuff like that is so powerful because it unites the nation. You know, people always remember and know and become more patriotic to be where they're from. You know, and you look at ours, you know, and this is something small, but it's also big, because if we are as patriotic as other people, we know how to be firm and strong. And by patriotic, I don't mean black or white. I mean all of us. You know, like if you are a proudly South African, you will know what will damage you, you know, and you will not do what will damage you or your country or the economy for that matter. Everyone will try to deal with problems the right way.
You know, it's funny. There will be people watching this going, you know what? America has challenges of its own. Every nation has its challenges, whether it's the economy, not doing enough for people. I want to end on a good note, because you are impassioned and you are talking about rebuilding, and we can see that. And that is taking place right now. You're an amazing export. You are investing in domestic talent, whether it's music talent, producing talent, tech talent, and small companies as well. There are amazing things going on in South Africa. And just talk to me about how great it is to be back on the road, to be able to be back on the road and doing some of the things that you love. And as someone who is a representative of what is incredible talent in many spheres in South Africa.
It's so amazing to be back. You know, one of the things that was being affected was me continuing investing. You know, I have a very soft spot for the continent, you know, and the growth. And like I said, giving our people opportunities. You know, I think we are one of the countries that has one of the biggest potentials to be something much great. I just can't wait for us to get to that space where we are able to govern ourselves. And, you know, and when I cry, when I tweet, you know, it's not from a political point of view. It's, you know, it's not, I'm not a member of any political party. It's from a South African who's concerned about the future of a country, you know, a South African who is very passionate about a country and its people, you know, and we have one of the most beautiful people in the world. Everyone who's been to my country will tell you, you know, and I often get embarrassed to even tweet about our issues because I have this following of the entire world watching, and I feel like I'm airing our dirty laundry, you know, to the world, and people are going to start questioning our country, and then they will not go to our country because they're like, oh, so you guys are burning houses. We're not going to go there. But then there's times where I'm like, okay, I really need to speak up, you know, and this was one of them, you know, where I just felt like I need to do something. And we were not even calling, this is not a matter of calling international media. It's our internal thing that needs to be sorted, you know, because we are destroying ourselves, you know what I mean? But I'm very passionate, and it's unfortunate that, I mean, I'm even here talking about our dirty laundry, you know, to the world, you know, and I'm hoping we're going to fix things and eventually become a strong nation.
So much potential. I have been to your beautiful nation and it has incredible potential. We believe. Natty, fantastic to have you on the show. Come back and talk about more fun things soon, please. And we hope
you
get the progress you're asking for. Yeah, the DJ producer, Black Coffee. Great to have you with us, so thank you. And keep raising your voice. I think that's the other thing, the other message there. We're back after this. Stay with us. Welcome back to First Move, and it's another First Move Friday, a firmer Friday, in fact, on Wall Street. The US reporting a strong retail sales pop as consumers still go out to eat and shop. Airlines moving higher too. President Biden may soon lift restrictions on Europeans traveling to the United States. That was discussed between Angela Merkel and himself yesterday. Tech merger speculation is helping nurture the Nasdaq too. Reports say Intel is in talks to buy rival chipmaker Global Foundries for some $30 billion, a deal that will represent Intel's biggest corporate purchase ever. Global Foundries had recently been planning to go public too. If you remember, we asked them on this show. I think the antitrust guys might have a problem with that, but perhaps with strategic importance, they'll get away with it. To an ill-fated IPO now. However, on another day of Didi dumping, Beijing officials swarming the offices of the ride-hailing app, an intensification of China's ongoing cyber crackdown, as we've already discussed already on the show, the big risk that officials are building a criminal case. Didi has fallen some 12% since going public on the New York Stock Exchange last month, and that's the performance there. And another momentous Moderna moment, shares of the COVID vaccine maker are higher on news that it will soon be added to the S&P 500 index, higher by almost 7%, as you can see. Now, the world's biggest sporting event is now just 1 week away. The games are still a go, despite COVID cases reaching a six-month high in the Japanese capital. Some athletes are also having to quarantine due to testing positive or coming into contact with someone that has. CNN's Blake Essig joins us live now from Tokyo. Blake, great to have you with us. And actually, this is something that I hadn't considered. You can vaccinate all the Olympic athletes, but if they come into contact with somebody around them that tests positive, then they have to go into quarantine. And how do they train? How do they follow their strict diets under those conditions? It seems like it's becoming a challenge.
Yeah, you know, Julia, there's no question that these Olympic Games are going to test these athletes, not only on the, you know, whether, you know, in competition, but preparing for competition. Again, I mean, they could come into contact with somebody, you know, whether it's in the dining hall or at the gym, that could potentially knock them out of competition. Of course, you know, the decision to ban all spectators for roughly 97% of Olympic events will also play a role, especially for those athletes who feed off the crowd's energy. You know, there's a lot of potential issues, you know, surrounding what these athletes are going to have to deal with, and the lack of spectators is responsible for some of those people, like Australian tennis star Nick Kyrgios, to actually withdraw from the games because he says playing without spectators just doesn't feel right. So yeah, as you said, Julia, a lot of there are a number of hurdles that these athletes are going to have to deal with in the build-up to the games, and then once the games actually take place here in about 7 days.
Yeah, in addition to the stress of simply competing and wanting to be at the top of your game. Now, speaking of someone being at the top of their game, we were 50-50, or at least he said he was, Novak Djokovic, after he won the Wimbledon final, about going to the Olympics. And it now seems he's confirmed he will be there.
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, when you hear of, you know, some athletes dropping out, and then you hear of a guy like Nick Djokovic that's going to actually show up, and the potential for a Naomi Osaka, a Simone Biles. I mean, that's what's going to get people excited about these games. You know, at this point, you know, for athletes, the biggest challenge is going to deal with, again, the fact that a lot of the people in Japan don't want the games to take place at all. Ongoing health and safety concerns are the primary reason that these games have been and continue to be so deeply unpopular. The majority of Japanese people, even though with the games are just about a week away, people I spoke with just a few hours ago told me that it's still not too late for them to cancel. They say after the world spotlight has come and gone, it's the people of Japan that will continue to be left to deal with the consequences. Now, this is what's being said in the buildup to the games, but when you talk about some of these big-named athletes that are going to be coming and performing at the highest level on the biggest stage, you know, there's a lot, there is excitement. I've talked to people who are excited about these games after a rough year, you know, across the board dealing with the pandemic and the fact that we are still dealing with the pandemic. Especially here in Japan, you know, a lot of people are looking to the Olympics and hoping, you know, for excitement for these big name stars to really show on the biggest stage and bring some happiness, even if it's only for 16 days.
Yeah, well, I'll be cheering them on from home. It's just a shame they can't get that cheering where they're competing. CNN's Blake Essig in Tokyo. Safety first, as always. Thank you for that. We're back after this. Stay with us. Welcome back to First Move. And tech-based tutoring, GoStudent, an online tutoring startup that connects students with private tutors on a range of topics, including maths and physics, has become Europe's first edtech unicorn. The Vienna-based company is now rapidly expanding with the backing from major investors, including SoftBank and Tencent. Joining us now, Felix Oswald. He's the founder and CEO of GoStudent. Felix, congratulations on raising the fund. Just talk us through what you're seeing on the platform, what the cost is, and how many students you have.
Yes. Hello, Julia. Great to be here today. With GoStudent, we have this mission to build the number one global school. And how do we do that today? We connect children in the age of 6 to 19 with world-class teachers. Because this is really one of the most fundamental problems in education, lack of access to great teachers. We connect them in a one-on-one video chat environment, and we support the families and the teachers until the kid makes it out of school successfully.
So this is like supplementary education on top of the schooling that they're already getting, whether it's online or otherwise, given what we've seen in the last 18 months. Your fundamental asset, and you've touched on it, is your teachers. Do you actually have a global talent pool? How do you select them? Talk me through this, because this does feel like the pivotal point.
Exactly, exactly. Mm. And the teachers are really the heart of the platform and of teaching and education in general. Education can only be as good as the quality of the teacher. And we have created a really sophisticated process in order to make sure that we can only get to the best teachers. First, we check the subject skill set level. So is the teacher good in mathematics, for example, good in German or English? Then we check the pedagogical skill set. So is this teacher able to explain something in easy and very like understandable terms for the kids? And then last but not least, we do a really proper background check and an onboarding quiz to make sure that also the start of the teaching can be as smooth as possible.
And what's the cost of a class?
Yes. So, for example, in Europe, we are actually 30% cheaper for the one-on-one classes than what you find in traditional offline learning centers. So the cost is really, it's an affordable service that the mass population can have access to, and it is not something that only the top 2-3% can afford.
And just in terms of cross-selling, how many of your students actually come on to get teaching, for example, for a maths class, and then decide, actually, maybe I'll get some tutoring for English because I like what I'm doing? I guess I'm asking the cross-selling opportunities here of supplementary teaching.
Yeah, the cross-selling opportunities is really huge, because once you start with a subject, the majority starts with mathematics. 40% of people start with that. And once you have this first like success experiences, then this is the perfect timing in also getting into other subjects. So we have on average, like most of the kids, like 70-75% of the kids, after 3 months, they try out a second subject because they see that the service is improving their grades tremendously.
Explain what happened during the pandemic, because this is quite fascinating. I've seen some comments from you suggesting actually you saw less use during the pandemic. And I just wondered whether that was perhaps lack of exams that people needed extra training for, or just enough of being online when so much of the teaching was online.
That is a really good question, Julia. So first and foremost, a large amount of people that requires additional help in the afternoon are people who want to practice and improve for their upcoming tests. And one thing that we have seen in the year of the pandemic is that during the time when schools were completely locked down and closed, that we have seen less exams, less pressure at school, and less pressure resulted in less families searching for afternoon-related tuition services. At the same time, we have seen a huge spike of teachers and people generally looking for remote jobs, and the mindset accelerated towards digital services, video calls in general.
Now, I know you're raising money, I know you're in expansion mode, but if you look at the the number of students you have, and I believe it's around 400,000, and you're looking to get to 800,000 by the end of the year, what they're paying versus the costs of acquiring this teaching staff, never mind platforms. Are you profitable?
Yes, so we have profitable unit economics. We are really pushing hard on geographical expansion, already present in more than 15 countries, 20 by end of the year, and really looking forward to bring more affordable and high quality education to more families around the globe.
Where are the expansion opportunities? Because we've spoken to a number of sort of similar players in this space. Coursera in the United States is a classic example. Baidu in India. Do you avoid those markets? Because there are plenty of others, particularly in Asia, I think, where this kind of model, I think, would work, particularly given the ability to be online and the global teaching opportunities that it presents.
I can assure you by now, like, the opportunity is there globally. And the only two markets in which we are not going to expand soon is China and India. Because in China and India, you have brought up Baidu's, for example, you have already great companies there, but they are very busy in their own home markets. So there's enough time for us and room to grow elsewhere.
Okay, we shall watch this space. Felix, great to have you with us. Felix Oswald there, the CEO of Go Student. Now you're watching First Move. More to come. Stay with us. Welcome back to First Move. Valued at an estimated $180 billion, gaming is actually more lucrative than the film and music industries combined. Dubai-based PLG believes that more than just entertainment, games are a platform to reach larger and more engaged audiences. As part of our Think Big series, Anna Stewart shows us how it connects brands like Coca-Cola and Adidas with gamers around the world.
Eyes peeled, attentive ears, quick reflexes. This is how almost 3 billion people around the world choose to spend their time.
It's not the most relaxing of pastimes, that's for sure.
Matthew Pickering realised early on that consoles are much more than just fun and games. He's the CEO of Power League Gaming, an esports and gaming company based in Dubai.
So the big idea with PLG is that we'll produce the region's biggest esports tournaments and find new disruptive ways to produce content to reach gaming audiences for our clients.
Working with big international brands like FIFA, KFC and Intel, PLG produces different events and videos to engage the gaming community. Their content varies from competitive events to talk shows reviewing the latest releases or podcasts where gamers can share their tips. Last year, they opened a creative studio, the first of its kind in the region.
We invite five guys and girls down to the show to try and amplify their gaming careers, so give them the tools and give them the ability to be able to become self sort of proficient in streaming and content creation in the gaming space. So super, super excited.
As the world gaming industry grows nearly 9% yearly, the Middle East is leading the pack with annual growth of 13%.
For the Middle East and Africa, there's still quite a bit of room in terms of bringing new gamers into the market, in terms of really localizing games specifically for a more Arabic audience.
PLG is tapping into an audience of 230 million players in the MENA region, focusing on local gaming trends and speaking their language literally.
Something that's quite different or defining for PLG is that we are Arabic first, so we actively build strategies to connect with Arabic gaming audiences.
It's a sign that companies are looking at different communities.
Gaming's importance in society is really becoming more than just an entertainment platform. And brands and other industries, game developers and publishers, they can all leverage this trend in order to continue to grow.
So for Matt and his team,
luckily we've got a company full of very good Call of Duty players.
It's game on rather than game over. Anna Stewart, CNN.
And finally, on First Move, did your parents ever send you up to your bedroom? Once or twice, maybe more. Now, for one 18-year-old, well, his dad sent him up to space with a ticket paid for by his father Oliver Damon will travel with Amazon founder Jeff Bezos aboard the Blue Origin's first manned flight next Tuesday, making him the youngest ever astronaut. And just to be clear, this wasn't the person that paid the $28 million, by the way. The original bidder of that spare flight and that spare ticket had, quote, scheduling conflicts. Washing his hair. He'll apparently take another flight. Anyway, joining Bezos and Oliver will be the world's oldest astronaut, the wonderfully named 82-year-old Wally Funk. What an amazing person. To the trio, we wish them well. And that's it for the show. If you've missed any of our interviews today, they will be on my Twitter and Instagram pages. You can search for @JChasleyCNN. In the meantime, stay safe. Connect the World with Becky Anderson is next. And I wish you all a wonderful weekend.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN Flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.